Well, it is a great pleasure for my latest Nostalgia interview to meet Nina Curiata. And we have literally just met, and of course we were sharing experiences of being on the trains, coming to Canterbury and being in the wrong carriage. So I, even though we've only known each other for 20 minutes, I feel like I've known you, Nina, forever, because it's a very shared experience.
Thank you, Chris. Hello. Thank you for inviting me to talk to.
It's a pleasure to have on. Now, and of course, today is a really important day because it's Canterbury for Ukraine. And it's a great pleasure because I'll be, we've got that coming up in about 3 hours. And obviously I'm involved in that in terms of moderating the discussion and being involved with the walk and all the events. And this is a great opportunity to find out a bit more about yourself. And obviously your involvement with Canterbury for Ukraine, but your story more widely. So it's a great pleasure to have you here, Nina. And do you want to say a little bit, first of all, perhaps as we're talking about today's event, about your role with Canterbury for Ukraine?
Well, I was invited to take part in this discussion because we just met with Elena in London recently, and Elena is taking the active role in Canterbury for Ukraine, obviously. And the thing is that 1 year ago I published my first novel, which is about what is it like to be born being a Ukrainian in the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic during the last years of existing of the USSR, and then to grow up together with the independent Ukraine and go through all ups and downs of this country. And it is shown through the personal lens. And that is why I think, yeah, it's very symbolic, because this book is 1 year old, and it's important to talk about our independence from the perspective of the freedom to speak your native language, which is a huge privilege for Ukrainians, and it was not an option for all of us, because we were forced to go to Russian schools, Russian universities. Our parents couldn't get a job in Russified cities without knowing Russian. Ukrainian language was labeled as a language of peasants, villagers, collective farm workers, and nothing else, apart from some regions in the western Ukraine which was which joined the Soviet Ukraine 20 years later than the part of Ukraine from where I am. And that is why, yeah, I think the state independence is impossible without the personal independence, which means being who you are. And in the USSR, we were oppressed in many ways to express and show who we are. And not even all people have realized that during that time, because in the USSR you fight for your survival every day, you struggle to get products, you struggle to pay for everything you like if you are not privileged being a Communist Party member or something like that. If you are a collective farmer, you work from morning till evening at the collective farm, and then you have to feed your own family, and you work all the evening through the till the late night to have something to eat, literally. And that is why people were not thinking that much of higher levels of existence. Yeah. Like, they were not allowed to go to the church, for example, if they wanted to make a career. You had to be a Communist Party member, and communists do not go to the church. So people were really cut off so many freedoms which are taken for granted in democratic world, that I think this is a kind of a trauma.
Yeah.
Not being yourself, not being allowed to be yourself, and not even realizing that you're not allowed to be yourself.
Because I'm fascinated by the novel element that you mentioned, because that was your first novel.
Yes.
And based on your experiences, but you hadn't written before. Is that right? So was this something that you felt you had the urge to write? You had to do it. You had to write this novel because of your own experience. It was almost that sort of, you have to get that story out there. I'm always interested in that whole sort of interplay between the personal experience, the need sometimes to process something, to make sense of something in the light of, a creative journey, and a novel must be a fascinating way of expressing that.
I remember myself writing, not even writing, but creating as long as I remember myself living, because I've been writing poems since I was 3. Not even writing, I mean, my grandmother was putting them down, but they came to me somehow, and I would just declare it to my grandma, who would put it down in the copy book. Yeah. And then I became a journalist. So basically, all I do in my life for living is writing. But yeah, I felt that I wanted to make it sound, because I was annoyed at some point to be constantly disproving a couple of stereotypes existing in Ukraine. Because as we talked before this actual conversation, as you said that you are from one part of the country, and when you come to the other part of the country, there is another accent and maybe another dialect, and Ukraine is a very large country, yeah, geographically the largest in Europe, and there are 27 different regions and sub-regions, and there are different accents and different dialects. And of course, it's normal when you go like 1,000 kilometers, you can't find people speaking literally the same way, if only it is not the TV received pronunciation, right? So. And at the same time, there were some stereotypes, because as you probably know, a part of Ukraine was Russified starting from Catherine II, and then during Lenin's reign and Stalin's long-term totalitarian regime. And now Putin is obsessed with the idea of so-called Novorossiya. This is the term which Catherine II has created, and the idea was to make it Russian-speaking, and that is why the Russification took place in central cities of regions and in larger part of southeastern Ukraine. Cities were forced to speak Russian, whereas the regions, the villages around those cities were still speaking Ukrainian, but there was a stereotype that all people in southeastern Ukraine speak Russian. And when I was growing up in Odessa region, we all spoke Ukrainian there. But then when I was 9, I moved to Odessa, where, of course, there were only Russian schools. There were just 2 Ukrainian schools in the city of 1 million people. And I couldn't go there because it was very central and it was far. And that is why I knew that I would have no other choice than going to the Russian school. And in Odessa, I had to explain my mates from the class and from the university. They were quite surprised that we are still speaking Ukrainian at home, because I lived with my mother and grandmother, and my grandmother, of course, she had to speak Russian in the street, in the market, in like on the tram or on the bus, because otherwise it would be very unusual to speak Ukrainian in the street. But at the same time, between us, we were speaking Ukrainian. And my friends, when they visited me, she didn't switch to Russian. She spoke Ukrainian with them, knowing Russian perfectly. And it was a bit of unusual of me. And in that way, I felt that I differ a bit from those people. And then when I moved to Kyiv and I finally could speak Ukrainian with people in the street, in the office, etc., etc., one and the same question followed me all the time from them. But why do you speak Ukrainian? You are from Odessa. And I was just tired to explain that, yes, I'm from Odessa, but Odessa was Russified, and I'm from Odessa region, and all people in Odessa region speak Ukrainian, if only they are not Bulgarians, Moldovans, other nations living in Odessa region, but not Russians. Because Odessa is far from Russia on the map. It's probably the most distant city from Russia on the map, if you look at the map. But then there are stereotypes which were effectively used during the Soviet time. And then there are two stereotypes which followed me all the time. If I said that I was from Odessa, people said, why do you speak Ukrainian? You must be speaking Russian. Or, without knowing that I'm from Odessa, when I spoke Ukrainian, one and the same question was asked, are you from Lviv? Your Ukrainian is so perfect, you must be from Lviv. And again, I should go with the same phrase, no, I'm from Odessa region, and people were very surprised, and then all this story went on and on and on. And I was so sick and tired of all this during all my life that basically I decided that, A, I'm not the only one in this country in that situation. There is a lot of us. And B, I really need to tell this story because you live like in an underground position because you speak at home, you speak Ukrainian at home, and then you just shut your friend's door and switch to Russian if you live in Odessa, Kharkiv, Dnipro, Zaporizhia, any other city which has been Russified. So I felt that I must tell this story, and I'm surprised how common this story turned out to be, because when people read this book, they say it's about me.
Yeah. Well, and I was saying, as you were talking as well, I was reflecting on how in a different age, my own grandparents, if it hadn't been for the Second World War, they would have remained in their villages, in their towns. They would never have met. And they, I think, when they were both, so they met during the Second World War, they were both engaged to people in their villages. And so their whole life changed. You know, I wouldn't be here if they hadn't met. And now it's quite normal for my generation to be living away from home. But going back two generations, it was unthinkable that the family would be split up. You know, it was quite normal. You'd work on the farm or you'd work in whatever the local industry was. That was just the sort of the expectation. So I've got family members going back a few generations who lived their whole life in the same village and often just, you know, took on the occupation of their father or their grandfather. So what you're highlighting there, that sort of sense of fitting in and not fitting in, even sometimes, and this is the real paradox, isn't it, in your own country, when there are different expectations that you don't speak the way you're expected to speak. Or, I mean, I'm from Wales, and I suppose there's an analogy of sorts there about being a Welsh person but within the United Kingdom, but living in a part of the UK where Welsh is not spoken, but also not being particularly, you know, Welsh-sounding myself. There's all those identity things, and I'm only aware of them, really, when I'm outside of Wales. My Welshness is, if anything, accentuated because I'm in an environment where people may sound more like me than I sound when I'm in Wales, but I'm very proud of those roots, but I'm more proud of them when I'm not going to use the word in exile, that's not the right word, but when I'm outside of that domain, and one can never escape one's heritage. So I think, just on the 2 or 3 minutes of what you've outlined already, I think you're capturing something really essential, which is intergenerational, but also that sense of belonging and not belonging, and how you can sometimes have a better, maybe in your case, your Ukrainian identity is far from diminished when you're outside of Ukraine. If anything, in that sense, it's enhanced because you're aware of how you are appreciated, understood, characterized by people outside of your, if you like, your homeland.
Yeah, this book is really about the identity thing because its main character has always to prove that she exists.
Yeah.
Because if we put it simple, all the time she hears, but if you speak this language being from that area, you must not be existing. No, no, no. You should be doing this, or you should be belonging to there. And interestingly, when I was coming to the Western Ukrainian regions, I love Western Ukraine, and I was thinking that finally I will speak my favorite own mother language with people who will totally understand me. they've been saying, oh, but you are from Odessa. No, 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 you don't belong to us. Which is, I mean, most of my friends are from the Western Ukraine. I even didn't want to marry a man from Odessa because I wanted my children to speak Ukrainian, and I married a man from the Western Ukraine to be sure that he will speak to our children in Ukrainian. But when I came to Western Ukraine, some people were saying, but how do you know Ukrainian? Where did you learn it? And I was saying, this is my native language. And they said, no, 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 it's not possible. So yes, it's not just that you have to prove your own right to speak your own language, but you also have to prove that it is your own language. It is your native language. You don't pretend to be Ukrainian. You are Ukrainian. And I think that is why this book has got such a nice response from the audience, because they say, yes, this is us. There is a lot of us. And yeah, as I said, you don't even realize when you are diminished. You don't even realize that you are diminished.
And also what you've highlighted, I think, is what happens when we are defined, circumscribed, if you like, by somebody else. We are seen through the lens of somebody else. Our identity is threatened, questioned, critiqued, maybe even ridiculed by someone who says, you can't be from there, you don't sound like you're from there. And of course, you have your own identity, you can very, very aware of, self-aware, proud of your roots, but somebody might just say, sorry, that doesn't fit with their lens. So you're having to prove something that you shouldn't have to prove, because you're trying to explain yourself through the lens of somebody who doesn't necessarily feel very receptive to your own particular background. So am I right in thinking that that is something that is that's the essence of what people in all walks of life, in all cultures, in many ways, having to deal with on a daily basis, but we're not aware of it. We just take it for granted. We avoid them sometimes. I've been in positions, I've been in cinemas, and I've had avoiding conversations with people where I know that the direction of travel, as it were, is not a very good one. People say, oh, so you work in a university, or you teach religion, and which is true. And then they start telling me their thoughts about particular religious groups. And I'm thinking, and they're doing it very loudly in a cinema, for goodness sake. And I'm thinking, I don't want this conversation. In fact, actually, I'm embarrassed to be having this because somebody's telling me their prejudices and imagining that I'm going to be receptive in some way to it, when really it's just a stream of consciousness. So what you've highlighted is something I can imagine will really resonate with people, if I'm sure it already is.
Yes, absolutely. And I think the most scary thing is that these internal stereotypes, I'm 100% sure they've been created by the Soviet regime to divide people, because all authoritarian regimes are based on breaking the horizontal bounds and links between people. And that is why it was very good to keep Ukraine like a bit of disintegrated, keeping people a bit like suspicious to each other, especially after the repressions, when you could be reported by your neighbor that you didn't give all the wheat to communists, for example, and you dared to save something for your own children to survive. So yes, people were naturally scared and disintegrated, and these stereotypes are used today because, for example, what was the first absolutely crazy justification of Vladimir Putin to invade Ukraine 10 years ago? He said, there are Russian speakers, and that is why they are Russians, which is not. And this is very important. This is not the book about the difference between different regions of Ukraine. We are proud to be different. And we have a lot of memes, like a person from one region comes to the region with another dialect, and it's always funny, and it's normal. Every country has different dialects, but it's very important to say that not all Russian speakers are Russians in Ukraine. That most of them are just Ukrainians who went through this language trauma. And this is very important thing to know. Even if you meet a person from Ukraine whose native language is Russian, 90% is that this person is not ethnic Russian who came from Russia. This is the person who just went to the Russian school, or whose parents went to the Russian school. And this identity thing, this is something which people are coming back today. And this also has a lot of, it requires a lot of brevity and attempt, because it's always traumatic. And this is painful. And sometimes I hear that people cry reading these things. So basically it's where it starts at the language and family level, it ends on the level of your country, and sometimes it ends with the armed fight for your country. Because the first thing Russians do in occupied regions is they change the signs with the names of cities and towns. They replace Ukrainian names with Russians. Whereas they say there is no difference which language to speak, the first thing they do is bringing Russian teachers, bringing Russian exercise books to the schools, and changing the local names, the names of towns and cities, as I said, to Russian. And this is about your belonging and identity.
And it's one of those paradoxes, isn't it, though? Because we live in a world where, through social media, we have access to countries, cultures that would have been unprecedented. You know, at the flick of a button, at the click of a mouse, we can see what somebody's doing in the other part of the world. We can correspond with them. We can talk with them. And yet, we're often beholden to our regions. And I mean, I was mentioning earlier, my children are only living in this part of the world because I happen to get a job here, but they have traces of a local accent. And it, you know, if I'd been somewhere else, if I'd stayed in Wales, they would undoubtedly have traces of a Welsh accent. But there is the irony that on the one hand, we are more aware, we can be more of what's going on in the world around us, but there's also a sense in which we're also very much beholden to our own culture, our own language. And it's that interplay of knowing more about the world, but also in some ways, perhaps, and you've highlighted that almost that lack of tolerance sometimes that comes to light. In the example here of them, Russians coming and almost trying to wipe away, change the identity of a region in order to match their own sort of outlook. And it's kind of, you know, on the one hand, humanity is moving in one direction, but there are forces that are the converse of that. And then you've got that dialectic, you've got that struggle, you've got that sort of sense of this is not okay, you know, forward thinking against regressive thinking. And those are forces that we see in lots of countries, in various elections, and you see that sort of like, who's going to win that fight? What will we think in 50 years' time? What will the generations to come in 100 years' time think, looking back, in terms of which forces win out short-term versus long-term?
Yeah, I just thought... I think my family story is very interesting in this way, because as you said, your family has been settled up in the same village in Wales for generations. And my family history is like my region's history. Everything changes and you change. So my ancestors came from Poland when... Again, Catherine II occupied a part of former Ottoman Empire, and she invited some aristocracy from Poland to bring their people to free land, and like landlords brought their people belonging to that community. So there was Polish community who moved to Odessa region. So they were Poles, keeping their traditions, keeping their religion, keeping their prayers in Polish. But they Ukrainized somehow. So they adopted to the language which surrounded them, right? But at the same time, you keep some Polish words, you keep some Polish mentality, you keep Polish recipes. And this is very particular. And even without knowing that you might have Polish roots, you eat Polish food. And then you come to Poland and you see that the menu in the Polish kitchen cafe is 100% what you've been fed in your childhood at your home. Because this is exactly what my grandma was cooking. And another thing is that if you live in the region which suffers from multiple, okay, not suffers, but if you live in the region which goes through multiple changes, multiple revolutions, wars on your land, your family reacts to it. So my great-grandma and great-grandpa from that Polish branch of my family were moved to Odessa region. They grew up. And then, for example, my grandma, when she was a teenager, went to Odessa, and she had some, they had some quite wealthy relatives, and she's been sent to them to Odessa. She's been grown up in Odessa. She married an officer of the White Guard, because Odessa belonged to the Russian Empire, and he was an officer there in the army. And then the First World War started, and he disappeared. She didn't know where he was. Her children died of some infections, and they were buried in Odessa. Her sister, who also was married to a white officer, died in her labor. And so basically, my grandma found herself in Odessa when the power was changing almost every day, from Russians to Greens to Whites to whoever else, to Blacks. Those were the names of the parties and political movements. And she lost her husband. He was lost in the war. She didn't know where he was. And at some point, the people from her village, imagine no mobile phones, but people were connected somehow. So they came to her and said, listen, we are going back to our village. This is about your roots. So there were a group of those people deriving from the same village in Odessa, in a major city, who knew each other and kept those horizontal connections. She took her nephew, who was 6 months old, and the only thing she took was the blanket and the gold jewelry which left from her like step-parents. She considered them to be step-parents, despite she has her own parents in the village. And they came back having one horse and one carriage, and there was like 20 people. Some of them were on the carriage, some of them were following by foot, then they changed, then they had sleep. They were sleeping in the fields. It's like 160 kilometers between Odessa and the village where they were going to. And she arrived to that village, and she's been living where she was born with her nephew, who became her stepson. And then the World War I took her husband, but at the same time, this war gave her another husband, the second one, who came from the war prison. He was a prisoner of war in Austria. He came back, and they married. And then Soviet Russia occupied Ukraine, and there is another challenge. There are like repressions, so-called collectivization, collective farms. People had to give everything they had to the collective farms, all their horses, cows, allotments, fields, everything. So they went through it, and then, as you probably know, Ukrainians didn't want to go to collective farms because they are quite good farmers. They care about their land. They were doing well without Soviets. There was no revolution in Ukraine. The revolution was in Russia, and then Soviet Russia just decided to invade Ukraine because Lenin said that Soviet Russia is not possible without Ukraine. They invaded. Ukraine was begging Europe for the help. There was no help. Ukraine defeated to Russia in 1918, and since then Ukrainian villagers didn't want to go to collective farms. And what Stalin did, he organized the terrible genocide of artificial famine. And by that time, my great-grandma has got two daughters. One was 10 and one was 3. And this little one who was 3 was my grandma. And she remembers that. They were sitting in the house, and then Komsomol members and communist members came, and they were seeking for the wheat, for the bread, for everything. They found some wheat, and they just threw it away. So the slogan was, we are helping Red Army, but it wasn't given to the army. It was just thrown away. So the task was just to leave people without anything to eat. And by that time, the only thing how people could survive was to sell gold for bread. And this gold, which my great-grandmother took from Odessa, from her step-parents, saved the whole family. So she saved her own family, all her cousins' families, etc., etc. So what did she do? She took one gold thing, one piece of gold jewelry, went by the train to Odessa. It was all illegal because the villages were guarded by communists. People were not allowed to leave, so she risked her life every time. She went to Odessa, went to the special shops which were organized again by Stalin regime to take gold from people. She took instead some voucher. People were given vouchers for that gold. And then you could exchange that voucher for a piece of bread, for a loaf of bread. But it was too cheap. It was too high, but it was too pricey to change like one golden ring for a loaf of bread. So what did she do? Again, she had a relative who's been working at the railway station, and illegally, he allowed her to take the train to Kuban. Kuban was a former Ukrainian region, by that time annexed and belonging officially to Russia. This is where Ukrainian army is advancing now, by the way. So as soon as Kuban belonged to Russia, there was no famine. And she went there, and she could exchange this certificate given her for one golden ring for like a big sack of flour and a few loaves of bread. So she made her way back by a few trains to the village. Her stepson, who was like 16 by then, would meet her at the station guarding her because people were following those who had some bread. People were starving. People lost their minds. And because of that gold, she saved her family. And if you ask me how did she manage to keep that gold, because communists would come every day searching for that. Because if your family is not dying of hunger, it means that you are hiding something. So they would come a lot of times to find that. But the secret was that she put that gold into the ground, into the shed where the cow was kept. So literally, where the cow was standing, under her limbs, there were golden things which saved the whole family. And when I was a little girl, my grandmother would tell me everything. And this was a cognitive dissonance because you go to the school and you are taught that Soviet army was fighting for the best, to give farmers and workers the best, and the farmers should help the army, and at the same time you come back home and your grandmother said, oh yes, I remember Soviet soldiers. When I was 3, he took me by my hand and threw me away. And this is something which is a kind of, you understand that the school is saying you one thing,
yeah,
and your family says you the other thing. And then another question comes to your mind, am I from the wrong family?
Yeah.
Is there anything wrong with my family? If they didn't want to share the bread with the army, were they bad? Is there anything wrong with me? And this Soviet propaganda is going from everywhere, and you don't think when you are 6 that there is probably something wrong with my country.
But in your case, I mean, that's a phenomenal story. And actually, it just made me think, I saw a film completely, I'm off at a tangent, but a film called Lone Star at the BFI in London last week, which was set on the border between Texas and Mexico. And it's about that same thing, about the different stories, the Mexican story, the American story, and who has the right, inverted commas, narrative. And do you teach both? You know, is education about learning about history from different perspectives, or is there only one normative way? So that really affected me. That was a mid-90s film which I saw just a few days ago. But in terms of what you're saying, must mention as well, because my children are quarter Polish as well, and those children, they're in primary school, the girls are now just starting secondary school. They are learning Polish, and more Polish than Welsh, it must be said. That's another story. They align themselves much more with the Polish than the Welsh element. That's another element. But what you're saying there is really powerful, because you presumably learned, you know, everything you just told me is something that's been handed down, I'm guessing, orally from your grandmother.
Yes.
Now, how powerful that you've remembered this, that you're telling me this story. Now, it's a story that nobody else could tell because it's your story. It's a bespoke story. It's a unique story. It's your own story. There may be people who can, you know, have similar stories. But you would never read that in a textbook. You'd never get that story from any, certainly not from a propaganda machine. But it's the most powerful story that you can tell. Now, when you were being told that by your grandmother, presumably, you weren't imagining, oh, I must remember this because in 30 years' time or whatever it might be, I will need to relay that in a, you know, in a podcast or something like that. But you've remembered that story, and that story has stayed with you. Now, I'm guessing that that is something that has affected you greatly. But it's not just, it's actually more about who you are. It's you need to know that story. And maybe it's only in, I'm guessing, particularly in the event, in the, what's happened in the last 2 or 3 years in Ukraine, that has really come out so much because it's brought out all those wounds, all those traumas. So what your grandmother lived through and she experienced is mirrored by your own experience. But is there any sort of written documentation of any of that? I mean, in a way, you're doing that job now very powerfully, but are there any artifacts, any diaries that did your grandmother write anything down? Is her story being told through you and you alone? And it's so amazing, and she must be so, you know, would be so proud of you for the fact that you're honouring her legacy and telling a story that needs to be told because nobody else will tell it. And actually anybody else's story will be one that actually misrepresents or actually is a complete fabrication of that story.
If we are talking about the famine, this is the largest collective trauma for Ukrainians. It's not just my hypothesis. There are social psychologists in Ukraine who say that this is the largest collective trauma. Yeah. Because food is the first level of like your existence needs, right? And when you are deficit of that, you basically are really either dehumanized or dead. And we were all traumatized because we are the grandchildren of survivors.
Yeah.
We all are the grandchildren of survivors, if not only people though who came from other regions, from like Russia, Kazakhstan, Moldova. If your parents and grandparents were born in Ukraine, you are inheriting this transgenerational trauma. And I will tell you why. This is not the thing that it's not like the home education lesson when your grandma just says, okay, you are old enough, sit down and I will tell you. No. This is not like this. This is, if you drop a piece of bread, you are told, and now pick it up, make a cross, and eat, kiss this bread and eat it. And it has nothing to do with the religion. This is not a church rule to kiss the bread which is dropped. But the bread was really something sacral. You couldn't drop the bread. You couldn't throw it out. The only way to throw the bread was to give it to chicken or to birds. You couldn't just put it in the garbage bin. That's the point. Because bread was something which people lacked heavily and they were dying for not having bread. And there are a lot of people who remember that they've been forced to eat everything, every single piece in their plate. And they were not allowed to leave the table until they ate everything. Because it's a sin to leave the food. And this is subconscious. This is subconscious. People don't realize it. Because my mom, for example, my mother, still used to force me to eat everything. Because her another grandma, the mother of my grandfather, had 11 children and only 4 survived the famine. So when she visited her paternal grandmother, she's been forced to eat everything because that woman lost 7 children because of famine. So we are all children and grandchildren and grandchildren of survivors. And only during the term of our president, Viktor Yushchenko, the former president of Ukraine, he was the first person who brought the topic of this genocide to the society, and he started to fight for recognizing it as a genocide, because a few millions of Ukrainians died by that time, and he started to work on the memorizing of that huge crime against humanity, I would say. And we have a museum of famine, and we have monuments to famine, and every autumn, every last Friday of November, people really share their family stories. And this is, like you said, this is like coming out that I'm also from that family, and I am from that family. And my grandmother never told me anything about this, but finally I came to know that there are three her sisters buried in their allotment because they were not allowed to go to the cemetery and to be buried there. So you can imagine how terrible that trauma was. And we are still recognizing this, and we are still coming to realize how bad it was. And it's very important to know this. But again, I was told these stories just meanwhile, you know, when, for example, my grandmother was cooking something like polenta, I would say. And she said, oh, yes, I remember that winter after World War II, when we had nothing, because Romanian army occupied our village and they took everything when they left. They took everything. We didn't have any chicken. We didn't have anything. But they left us a cow. But then Germans came and Germans took this cow. But luckily they left us another one, which was, pregnant cow.
Yeah.
So they left them another cow who was pregnant, and this cow brought a calf, and this cow had milk, and due to that milk, we survived the winter. So at that time, my grandmother was 10, and eating that polenta, she says, and I remember my mother used to hide a sack of corn, and from that cow's milk, she made the jar of cottage cheese, she salted it, and she preserved it for the winter. And during the winter, she would cook this polenta, cut it with the string on the table, and then she would add this salty cottage cheese, and this was very tasty. And now you can eat the same. So it was the way, like, you know, it's like 2-3 minutes while she is putting she is arranging the table for the dinner. And she's telling you this story, and you are fed with the both food and your family history.
And were you aware at the time? There's a similar with my grand, because my grandfather always said that he wanted one day to write everything down. And he did do it, but not till he was in his mid-80s. And in the last 10 years of his life, he wrote the whole family, when he met our grandmother in 1941 and onwards. But he used to do what sounds like your grandmother did. He always had some wonderful stories. Now, I probably don't remember it as lucidly as you do, but were you aware at the time of the significance of what you were told, or was it subsequently that you reflected and thought, gosh, I need to preserve this story? It's taken on added significance, because that was always my worry, and that's maybe why I always keep a diary and document things, that worry of somebody telling you something really important. But you know, you might, I don't know how old you were at the time, I'm guessing you were fairly young, but you know, there's a significant risk that, you know, in 5 or 10 years time, maybe five minutes later, you know, you're not going to remember that story in the way that it was told. So I have that need, quite a chronic need actually, to tabulate, to document everything that I'm told, because there's that fear, I suppose, of misrepresentation. Is that something that, you know, would you just have a good memory? But is that a story that came back to you years later, or did you just remember it sort of at the time that it was told, and did it sort of just get locked from that moment in your memory?
It wasn't locked because my grandma used to tell it every time when it was appropriate. I mean, it was absolutely normal to recollect something. Like, we were celebrating Christmas and she would say, oh yes, I remember when I was young, we would cook this and that. And of course, those were Polish dishes and that were a Catholic date for Christmas and Western date for Christmas, which was the 25th. And then she would say, and my father used to sing in the church, and as every Christmas, he went to the church on the 25th, and he came back and said, the priest said, there is no Christmas today, and the Christmas will be celebrated on the 7th of January. So this is another piece of the story, and Ukraine just came back to this date of Christmas last year. So this will be the first year when the Christmas will be officially celebrated on the 25th of December, which is, again, this is not just about calendar, this is about getting rid of the Soviet inheritance. Because the church which has been allowed in the USSR was fairly Soviet, because a lot of priests collaborated with the KGB, etc., etc. And coming back to the taking notes, my grandma was a storyteller, so she didn't take notes, but my grandfather used to have a diary since he was young. And interestingly, being born in the village and having lived all his time in the small town of like less than 20,000 people, working as a chief accountant of a hospital, he used to have quite, I don't know, at that time I would say it was quite elitist set of hobbies. He was playing guitar. He had a photo camera, not something everyone would have by that time. They used to go to Odessa to visit theaters, cinemas. They had like vacation full with cultural events, not just going to the seaside. And he did have a diary. And also, you reminded me of that when you mentioned your grandfather. Mm. He had a family tree book. So he created a family tree book and he was asking every member of family from all sides. And he died quite early. He died when he was 54. But he said that this book should be always kept by the eldest grandson in our big family. And it was. And finally, my mother just took that book back. So she has now keeping a book which has been created by her late father, whom he loved very much. So it was a kind of like, okay, we have this in our family. Maybe this is important. Maybe all people have that. And no, not all people have that. And this is another trauma, because in the Soviet Union, people were moved by the authorities far away from home. People were taken from one region to serving the army in the other region, and then they went to the university in another region, and then after the university they were forcibly told where to go to work. People sometimes didn't have choice. So basically it's not even a question of which region have you been born. To understand the background of the person, I prefer to ask where your grandparents have been born. Mm. Because since then you might be moved to any other region, but this is not your roots. And I'm referring to this, by the way, in my book, because I think two most powerful things of this cultural DNA is language and food. And that is why when I come to Poland, I understand that I belong to this culture as well, through the kitchen, through the cuisine, because I see and eat the same food. And yeah, it was something like untold precaution. Yes, outside you speak Russian, but here at home, we are not going to do that.
Yeah.
And we would celebrate Christmas.
Yeah.
And that's it. And I mention it, by the way, not about Christmas, but about Easter. This is another terrible thing which has been done. People were not allowed to celebrate Easter, especially the generation of my parents. So if you are an elder woman in the village, yes, you can go to the church, you work at the collective farm, nobody cares for your faith. But if a young man or woman wanted to have a career in science or in any other area, they should be being Komsomol members, Communist Party members, don't go to the church, and always, always on the Good Friday and the next Saturday after the Good Friday, they were so-called, they called it subotnik, which means that on the Saturday, people go and clean areas around their enterprises, universities, streets, or there will be some demonstration or something else. And that is why my mother could never come home Saturday before the Easter Sunday, because she was forced to go to the demonstrations or forced labor, being a science research fellow, not the worker or cleaning manager. But it was forced. And we have this tradition, the Easter tradition of painting eggs. We paint eggs in different colors, and the red egg is always this symbol of life and that the Christ has risen. And I remember when I was a child going to the primary school, I was never allowed to even touch the red egg. I was allowed to take and eat and touch eggs which were colored with the onions leaves. These eggs were brown, and this paint didn't paint my fingers. And in the school, the next Monday after the Easter Sunday, we would come to school and our teacher would say, children, show your hands. And we had to show our hands, and she could clearly see whose parents painted eggs and which children have this religious propaganda in their families. And then the special commission would visit every class and every teacher in whose class children had painted hands. This teacher would have a disciplinary, because these teachers work not efficiently, doesn't care about the anti-religious education, etc., etc. So again, this is something which you are growing up in, when the school says you one thing, at the home you are told another thing, and what is natural for your family, your family traditions. I mean, it's a lot of traditions are passed through the generations via food, via specific dinners or suppers, specific dishes which are cooked specifically for Christmas or specifically for Easter. And again, you understand somehow that this is not something which you even are allowed to talk in the school, because you will be punished and your teacher will be punished. And your mother will be punished, for example, at her enterprise, because sometimes somebody would report. And that's it.
Yeah.
That's very existential. That's very existential threat, and you don't even realize it because you're a child.
Is the novel that you've written one which is, albeit fictionalized, but you know you can correct me on that. But is it one that effectively is the story, the legacy that you know your grandmother bequeathed? Is it a story? Is it primarily based on your experience, or I suppose you're obviously drawing on that? But how much of it is your story? That, because it sounds like the most perfect outlet, other than a podcast, of course, but the most perfect outlet for you to tell that, because it's so powerfully wrought, and it sounds like that story, that novel had to be written. And the fact that you wrote it in the last 2 years when you were outside of Ukraine, it makes it all the more powerful. It was a necessary story for you to tell.
Yes, it is. It is. It was very important for me that this is 100% true story.
Yeah.
So it wasn't, I didn't have the goal to write my own autobiography just because I like the way I'm living.
Yeah.
This is not the case. But for me, as a journalist, of course, and the editor, a former BBC Ukrainian editor, I am trained to tell the truth, and it all has to be 100% fact-based, and all facts should be proven and checked. And in case when you are telling this painful, contradictory, traumatic experience, you should be 100% sure that no one would say, oh no, this is all elaborated, it wasn't that, it wasn't that bad, especially if the person was grown up, for example, in communist family, in privileged family, they had everything, they wouldn't suffer from the deficit, they wouldn't suffer from language discrimination. Coming from Russian-speaking region, there was nothing wrong for them because everyone understood them. And this is not even that person's fault. No, this is just they have been grown up in different conditions. And those people would say, oh, no, this is not true. This is not true. We all had everything to eat. We were well educated. We had everything. And this is like... So for me, it's very important to emphasize that this is 100% true story. And just for that reason, this is all mine experience. So yeah, this is fiction, but this is autofiction. I call it autofiction because this is 100% true. But for me, the fiction is not what is written, but how is it written.
Yeah.
So you shouldn't elaborate a character to make the book a fiction. This is the way you tell the story. There should be some metaphors. There should be poetry in the way you are telling it. There are some composed characters when you take the phrases you've heard from different people and then you put it together just because it's easier to understand. So in that way, yeah, there are some synthetic characters, but all the dialogues, all the phrases are pretty documentary, I would say, in terms of how I've been told this story of famine or how I've been told the story of their survival after the World War II. And eating this porridge, you know that those were Romanians who killed your great-grandfather because he gave collective farm horses to partisans. And those were Germans who were, of course, they were bad to local population. And by the way, they killed a lot of Jews, but your great-grandmother saved the Jewish family. And it is all told to you like... By the way, and when I asked my grandfather, my grandmother, but how did she manage? I mean, Germans were Nazi and they would kill not just Jewish people, but also the people who helped Jewish people. And how did she manage to hide the whole Jewish family in the village where everyone knows each other? And she said, oh, they lived in the corn plot. And I said, but how did they leave? And she said, their father was a tailor, and he was making clothes for people who would bring them some cottage cheese and milk and change it for their clothes. And I said, but how could he use the sewing machine in the allotment? And she said, but the corn is high and it makes loud sounds in the wind. And that is how the sewing machine couldn't be heard from the outside.
Yeah.
So this is like a by the way story. When she would unpack her sewing machine to make something for me, like a skirt or to make a curtain for the window. And she would say, oh yes, by the way, that Jewish man was sewing on his sewing machine in the corn at our allotment. And what was the question?
The question was about the particular autobiographical
nature.
My follow-up question to that is whether you felt the need to change names, there are always sort of, I suppose, legal sort of issues here, but you know, changing the names of people, but not changing the names of all people, but not necessarily letting on which ones are real, which ones are not. Because this is something that has affected me. Obviously, my story is a very different one, but the need to, because I keep a diary, and I've tried on occasions to try and think, how can I tell this story? And sometimes you, in order to tell the story, I suppose you can change some of the places, but you could change some of the names. But at what point do you lose the integrity of the story? Was that a battle that you had to face? Were you advised by the publisher to be careful about naming names in a way that somebody could come back and have a problem with that? Or was that an issue that at any stage you faced?
That's a funny one, because... I wasn't advised by a publisher, but what I did was I changed the names of negative characters.
Yes. Yeah.
And of course I changed the name of the main character, because again, it is not the point of writing my own autobiography, and it's not 100% coinciding with my autobiography, but the dialogues on the topic do coincide with the real dialogues. That's important. So my character lives a bit a different, I mean, she's got another education, some details not relating to the language issue and culture issue and identity issue can be different, but the phrases of teachers, the radio, TV, classmates, friends, enemies are pretty the same.
Yeah.
It is autobiographical by facts. It is, I hope, quite fictional on the craft level, on the level of how it is written. But most importantly is that it is not written in the recent 2 years, because I started it in 2008, but I was quite cross to hear, oh, you are from Odessa, you must speak Russian, or you speak Ukrainian, you must be from Western Ukraine, and then you know the story. And I decided that I just have to stop it, and I have to make it loud. But at that time, even the press in Ukraine, the media in Ukraine, were mostly Russian language, and there was no language issue. I had no idea how many people struggle with that like me. I didn't struggle with Russian because I am a native, almost native, I'm a fluent Russian speaker, of course, because of my education. But it was always preferable for me to be a Ukrainian journalist in the Ukrainian media, but there was not that many Ukrainian media in Ukraine, strangely. And a lot of media were like Ukrainian branches of Russian media, like Izvestia, a Russian brand in Ukraine, Ross Business Consulting in Ukraine, Interfax in Ukraine. So those were like Ukrainian versions of Russian media, Russian brands, and they were operating in Russian. And by that time when I started this book, I thought, who cares? Who will read this book? I mean, Nina, it's only your own problem. People wouldn't even think of this. Who cares? And I was quite afraid, actually, because I thought, who would support me? People from my little town in Odessa region, that's it, probably. And I was writing it for so long because I just simply hadn't enough time. I was a single mother, and I worked full-time as a chief editor. And this is not the position where you come back home and write something else after editing all the day and having a little child and crazy neighbors for whom this child is too noisy.
Yeah.
You have a house to run and child to grow. And that is why I was writing it like a couple days per year, being on a summer leave, for example. And it was in my drawer for quite a long time, basically. And I thought no one would publish it. And only my close friends knew. I have friends from literature circles because, as I mentioned, I write poetry as well. And a lot of my friends are either journalists or writers or editors or just very good linguists or philologists. And there were a circle of my friends who kept saying, Nina, you must finish this book. This book is needed. This book has to be published. And I offered it to two publishers. I have got no response from one publisher, and I've got a very polite, reasonable response from another publisher who published my poetry book previously. So it was like, fair enough, nobody needs it, okay. Maybe it's poorly written, maybe this is not interesting. And then a friend of mine, whose name is Oksana, who knew about this book being written, she sent me a link to a... it was like not a competition, but a newly created publishing house announced that they are publishing not just nonfiction, but they are starting to publish contemporary Ukrainian fiction literature. And they announced a call for, how would you say, for manuscripts.
Yeah, an invitation to submit a book, a story.
Yes. Yeah. So there was an invitation from the publishing house, basically, on the competitive basis. And I said, okay, Oksana, I will do it just because you ask. Because, I mean, those who know me as a poet didn't like it probably, and maybe this is just not that good book. And surprisingly, I've got an email saying that we selected your book out of 200 manuscripts, 200 files. They selected like 10 books to work with. And we had a Zoom call. I was in London by that time because I left Ukraine after the big invasion started. And I was sitting in the corner of the lobby of my office because I work for Tortoise Media as a Ukrainian defense editor. And I was speaking Ukrainian in that totally English language environment. And we had a publisher and editors and managers on the call. And the publisher was silent all the time. We spent an hour talking about how do I write, whom do I like from contemporary writers. There was a very smart man knowing everything about the contemporary literature, and it sounded like an interview, but it was not a job interview. They just wanted to understand how honest I was, I think.
Yeah.
And then they said, maybe you would like to ask any questions. And I said, yes, I have a question for the publisher. You were silent all this hour. What would you say? Have you got any questions, probably? I haven't heard a word from you other than hello. And he said, I have no questions. It's all clear for me. We will make a bestseller. Yeah, I was.
You think you're white and you say that?
Yeah. I suggest, oh man, come on.
Yeah.
I don't know. But then he said, but I think this book has been, I think this book needs to be longer, because this book ended when the invasion of Ukraine started in 2014. And he said, I think the Kyiv period of your life, because the book naturally folds in three parts, like Lyubashivka is the childhood and last years of the USSR, Odessa coincides with the teenage years, and independent Ukraine, which was just looking for its identity and forming its new identity, and then Kyiv part coincides with the main characters' more adult period of life, and it's like more adult period for Ukraine as well, because it's the Orange Revolution, so people do realize who they are, where they want to go, where they do not want to go. And he just said that I think the Kyiv period should be longer, so would you please write like 20-50 pages more? And I said, oh come on, I've been writing this for so long because I didn't have time. So I don't know how many years would it take to write 50 more pages. And finally, I was so involved in writing that I wrote like 120 pages, and I really enjoyed it. And
I bet you did it in a very short time.
Yes, of course.
But when you have a deadline, when you know that there's a sense of urgency,
oh yes,
then it's amazing how suddenly you can be so efficient. You can work to a deadline because you've come this far. And of course, the last thing you want to do, having spent 15 years working on this manuscript, the last thing you want to do now is spend another 15 years working on 50 pages. And you knew that that there was a publication in sight. So I bet you did it all in very, very short
time. In a couple of months. But even more important than the deadline, there was the faith that this book is needed. When the publisher said that we are making the bestseller, it was like, yes, it is needed. I'm really not the only one who needs this story to be published. There are more people, and this story will echo in their souls. And also, the last but not least, my son was not 2 but 17 by that time. That is why I had a plenty of time on my Christmas leave, and I just did it like for my pleasure. And
I'm just thinking, Nina, as you're telling this story, it's a wonderful sense of completion that your grandmother, while preparing food, would tell you a story, and she told it repetitively. You know, it was a story that you heard many times over, and all those years later, you crystallize it, you put it into a book, you're sharing it with us in this podcast, and now a whole new generation can get to know your story, and a story that can be written in a way that is accessible, has a universal element, because just as you were describing it, I found in my own experience something that resonated with there, and so there, you know, that's a hook I think that you've tapped into. So the publisher was undoubtedly right, this will be a bestseller. And just as we've finished the podcast now, where is the book at the moment? So at what stage are we? Has it been released?
Yes, it has been released a year ago. I presented it in Ukraine at the largest book fair in Lviv and then in Kyiv. And then I had occasional presentations in Krakow, Barcelona. I made a book tour in Austria this summer. I was in Vienna, Innsbruck and Graz meeting Ukrainian communities there. And the book is on the second edition now, so the second edition is published, so the total number of copies is 7,000. I hope there will be the next edition, because the book is in demand, because this is the book which people want to present other people. There is a lot of us. This is the point. This is not the unique story of one particular girl who is one of a kind for all Ukraine. No, the point is, there is a lot of us, and a lot of people say, yes, this is my story. This is my story. I remember that. I remember the deficit. I remember that Soviet copybook. I remember that Lenin commemoration day. I remember how our hands were checked in the school after the Easter. I remember my mother going to this demonstrations before the Easter Sunday and was not allowed to cook Easter bread at home, and many, many other things. And this is very important, just to make it sound, to make it loud in a way, because when you hide your family story, you hide it from yourself, you hide it from your children, and they have no clue how bad it was and how great it is just to speak the language you want to speak and to cook the food which you want to cook and to keep your own traditions. There is nothing wrong with it. You won't be punished for keeping your traditions.
And I have to ask, my very final question has to be your son. Now, he obviously was aware, I assume he was aware that you were writing this between the ages of 2 and 17. What's his take on this now that you've finished this? Did he ever think that you'd finish it? Does he want to read it? Has he read it? To what extent is this now something that is making him revisit and reframe and re-understand his own history?
Yes, you know, I think he is proud. Yeah. I think he is proud. But he's been proud since my two books of poetry have been published. Yeah. So, yeah, it's not the new thing for him that his mother is a kind of a writer, because my main occupation was the editor still. And unfortunately, he hasn't read it. He's the one whose name I changed. So I told him, your name in this book is Bohdan, while he is Ivan. And I used a couple of situations from his school, by the way, because there was a strange situation, quite an awkward situation, when the teacher of the geography teacher said that as soon as Crimea is annexed by Russia, it isn't considered anymore to be the most southern part of Ukraine. And she wanted the whole class, the whole form, to cross it out from the copybook and to put another geographical point on the map, which is not occupied by Russia, saying that this is now the most southern part of Ukraine. And I asked a question like, do we not consider Crimea to belong to Ukraine anymore? Yes, it is annexed by Russia, but it's not legal. It's not recognized by any normal country in the world. So sometimes, I mean, my son was a part of this story, because other parents said, yes, this is not normal. Our children shouldn't be taught that as soon as Crimea is annexed, this is not geographically a part of Ukraine anymore, and politically as well. So yes, I told him that I used this situation, and he was quite engaged in that, I mean, by that fact. And he only asked, and did you tell the teacher's surname? And I said, no, I changed it.
Well, I can't wait to hear what, when he does read the book, I'm sure he will, what his take is, because I love the way that it's passed down, not now just through your own family line, but actually that story is... I mean, it's same with my children, actually, who don't really watch or listen or read anything
of
that
course,
I do.
Why should they care?
And why should they? So in a way, that the rest of the world potentially knows more about what my children do or what I say about what they do, without mentioning their names, of course, than they do themselves. And that's why I had to ask. But Nina, what a wonderful story. What a privilege to have met you. Thank you so much for being... my latest guest on the Nostalgia Interviews podcast.
Thank you, Chris. It's been a pleasure. And sorry for a lot of details from a remote country, from a small town, from 40 years ago perspective, probably. But I still think it's interesting, and I hope this book will be translated, because we made a sample. And sometimes, yes, the story has to be explained before read, but I think... This is something. This is about the belonging.
Thank you, Nina.